I think in the interest of time, we'd like to be seated and begin this session of the symposium. It's my privilege to introduce the topic and the speakers this morning. This is a session conducted by Dialogue of Mormon Thought, Journal of Mormon Thought, and we'd like to express appreciation to Sunstone for inviting us to participate in the symposium in this way. By way of preface, I was reminded of the importance of this theme as I went home for lunch yesterday, lived just a few blocks from here, and found in my mailbox two-thirds of what has affectionately been called the unholy triad. Namely, I found the current issue of Dialogue and Sunstone in my mailbox, along with a copy of The Enzyme. Obviously, the holy part of the mailbox. In The Enzyme, this issue, and you probably haven't seen it, there are four articles devoted to learning. I don't know if this is a reaction to any particular event of the past year or simply something that was programmed some time ago, but there was a great emphasis on learning. Although, as might be expected, the idea of secular knowledge being subordinate to revealed knowledge was there, and there was a Mormon epistemology based on ideas such as obedience, it was very clear that the Mormon tradition of learning and knowledge is very strong. I was reminded of Leonard's description of his intellectual journey and finding scriptures that deal with God's intelligence and the fact that our salvation is somehow contingent on our doing away with ignorance. On the other side of it, of this question, though, is the emphasis in the Mormon tradition on behavior, on how we act. Unlike the commentary on Martin Luther, for us, the book of James is in our Bible within a Bible. For us, James is preeminent, and faith without works is dead is oft quoted. There's no shortage of emphasis on the role of works in terms of exaltation. In fact, it was often, as has been repeated in this very symposium, comments like, when my friends were confronted with religious issues that were difficult, whether they be historically based or theologically based or some matters of church policy, my friends would say, why does that matter? That's unimportant to me. It's how you act that's important, not what you believe. And yet we learned from another speaker, using the example of Jerry Falwell, who taught that we need not worry about nuclear arms and the eventuality of war because the millennium is going to come and the earth will not be destroyed. Those people who believe that obviously were more passive about trying to prevent war. So there's undoubtedly a relationship between belief and act. Fortunately, I don't have to resolve this question. It's being left to greater minds, and we're very pleased to have three persons today who I think represent some of the most popular and well thought of speakers and writers in Mormonism today. We will begin by hearing from Irene Bates. Irene is from Manchester, England. She has a degree in sociology from UCLA, has been involved in church positions, and is currently co-authoring a book with Gary Smith on the role of patriarchs in the church. She will be followed by Paul Edwards. Paul has a PhD in the philosophy of history and for 23 years taught at Graceland College in Lamoni on the subjects of history and philosophy. Responding to the papers of these two individuals will be Levina Fielding Anderson. Levina is currently the associate editor of Dialogue and has worked as a freelance editor and as editor of church publications as well. So without further ado, we introduce the subject, Being Mormon, Is It What You Believe or How You Act, with Irene Bates.
My first reaction to the question was both, of course. My second thought was, it depends. In the 19th century, when Mormons were a peculiar people, when polygamy set us apart, even then, it was the Mormon belief system that allowed such practices. Acting upon the belief tested and confirmed those beliefs sometimes. Today, the question is even less easily answered. On an individual basis, Mormons can fit quite easily into middle-class America. And within Mormon communities themselves, there is quite a spectrum of attitude and therefore lifestyle. Perhaps from an objective standpoint, our behavior in a collective sense can be seen as Mormon. And of course, activity is our own definitive term for faithfulness. To an observer, therefore, being Mormon suggests membership in a relatively homogeneous community with an active rather than meditative congregation, a community rather like a worldwide family whose members belong wherever they are. But even though belonging is a great comfort within that family, if we were to ask each individual member what it means to be Mormon, the same degree of homogeneity would not be reflected. Since I am being asked that question, I would have to repeat, it depends. If the question is a general one, in other words, being Mormon, is it how one believes or how one acts, I would have to ask, which Mormon, which belief, and which action? But if the question is personal, and that's really the only way I can deal with it, then I have to do a lot of unpeeling of the layers of my mind. First, some generalities, and then some personal comments and illustrations. As Mormons, we all subscribe to common ideas or principles. I have a long list of collectively held Mormon beliefs. But if we were to compare honest individual responses to each one of those tenets of our faith, we would find a variety of interpretations and some significant contrasts. As gospel doctrine teacher, I once asked class members in my own ward in Pacific Palisades what they would expect to find in an earthly kingdom of God. I gave them a list of features and asked them to choose three that for them would be paramount. I was surprised at some of the answers, but amazed at the wide diversity of opinion as to what mattered most. In a lesson on free agency, recently, for example, one lifelong member of the church held the position quite happily that, quote, we give up our free agency when we become members of the church. We simply follow the prophet or other church leaders. And I can imagine how provocative that statement might have been in some church settings. Subjectively, then, being Mormon means different things to different members of the church. We each choose our allegiances. As Jill and Brooke Dare have pointed out, quote, Mormons have always been able to exercise their personal freedom by rejecting church directives in whole or in part. The church is a voluntary organization. Members not only choose to belong, but determine the extent of their personal involvement by giving or withholding commitment or compliance, close quote. This kind of response is not uniquely Mormon, of course. Theologian Rosemary Radford Reuter has noted a similar selectivity among Christians in general. She says, individuals in their local communities of faith are always engaged in making their own selection from the patterns of received tradition that fit or make sense in their lives. But these differences remain unarticulated, held within the dominant consensus about what the revelatory pattern means. End of quote. That differences for the most part remain unarticulated in Mormon circles may well be true of my experience now. It was not always so. In the mission field, I found myself constantly in the role of moderator or wheel oiler, involved as I was with converts, only too anxious to test their beliefs in discussion or argument. These days at church, there is a constant longing in me to discover what each person really believes. But each of us is unique. We have different needs at different times in life, as been pointed out today. And it must follow that the variety in the nature of our response, unspoken or otherwise, will be determined by each individual's own hierarchy of beliefs and values. As Sterling McMurrin has observed, in religion, a person achieves a relation to the world as a totality. And as our beliefs become an essential part of our being, they do become the motivators of action as well as the determinants of the quality of those actions. Actions in their turn affect belief. They either reinforce or change them. Beliefs, strong beliefs though, will demand responses. It is only in our weaker beliefs that we waver and fail to respond. In addressing our question, I can only respond in terms of what being Mormon has meant to me through 28 years as a convert to the church. Davis Bitton has suggested that, quote, the process of conversion must be worth fuller exploration than it has received. What conversion means in terms of family relationships and friends, the painful, perhaps liberating, perhaps excruciating reevaluation of life and its meanings. It was all of those things. Brought up as a Methodist, attending until the age of 16, when I could choose to attend or not, I had become thereafter a weddings, christenings, and funerals member. My husband, as a member of the Church of England, had a similar record. When we joined the LDS Church in England in 1955, our life changed dramatically in very practical ways. At the time, I was a somewhat retiring person, and it was an effort at first even to walk into such an exuberant, busy congregation. From quietly serving my immediate neighbours and family, I was suddenly required or motivated to serve strangers in ways that probed my depths instead of merely utilising the skills that came so easily to me as a housewife. This meant less time for and diminished concentration on family and older friends, with some resultant stress. It meant seeing myself as a person instead of only in terms of my role as wife and mother of four. I began to realize that who I was, the kind of being I was important to those I loved as the service I was giving them. That recognition was born of the new challenges that were offered me that required development of abilities and character as well as a carving deeper into my consciousness. Teaching, for instance, when I had never taught before, demanded that I confront ideas and spiritual values so that I could know how I felt and therefore teach them in all honesty. My first calling terrified me. But I grew to love my group of 16-year-old girls. I was stimulated by their constant questioning, and I became totally involved in their joys and pains. Since then, I have run the gamut of teaching and administrative positions, all of them bringing self-discoveries and the accompanying growing pains. This growth brought repercussions in our happy marriage, where our personalities had meshed beautifully. My husband's strengths compensating for my weaknesses and vice versa. After being in the church for a while, we found we each were developing new strengths, and with them a new relationship that had to be worked through, but which had matured into a much more sharing partnership, full of interest and challenge. There were cultural adjustments too. Visiting teaching, for instance, for me is still hard, because I have to overcome the feeling that I am invading someone's privacy. You've heard an Englishman's home is his castle, and I think maybe that was responsible for an average of 25 to 30% in our statistics for home teaching, visiting teaching. But there was much change in the activity that I was involved in. But the wellspring of all this change was belief. Activity served as the arena for testing the beliefs, and most of the time involvement had validated and expanded them, so that some beliefs became knowledge through experience. Without action, it might have been difficult to maintain the new faith, but nevertheless, belief itself had been the generator for the courage, energy, and enthusiasm that had been required. Just as today, My beliefs are the strong but silken threads woven into my fabric of experience that help me survive in the church through different kinds of change and probably even greater challenge. In this hierarchy of beliefs and values which shape my response to this changing world, within the church and without, two are central. In a fluctuating kaleidoscope of beliefs, these two, since I joined the church, have remained consistent, and they are paramount in the sense that all others are contingent upon them. The most significant belief focuses on the atonement of Jesus Christ. From being quite small, I have always loved Jesus. In the Methodist Church, most of our Sunday school lessons revolved around the stories of Jesus. But God the Father troubled me. For years, I had lived with the sacrilegious thought that God had not only required his Son to suffer and die for us, but that he was unfairly taking the credit for Christ's sacrifice. After many long nights of discussion with some caring, thinking missionaries, I discovered the foundation, the rock upon which my house of faith would be built. For the first time, I understood that God the Father had allowed his Son, Jesus Christ, to express his love in such a way. He had not sent him, a crucial difference. This recognition of God's love brought a new, deep reverence in me, which, when I am still, colors my world. As I have listened to talks or comments on the atonement, whether there is a reverence to the mechanics, the parameters, the concept of ransom, or to the promises of redemption, I have realized that my own worship is grounded in something quite basic, regardless of the many dimensions of the doctrine, although intellectually they interest me very much. I am awed simply by the sheer quality of the love of Jesus Christ and of his Father for all of us. The universality of the gift, as well as the intelligence behind it, is only barely comprehensible. But for me, it would have been unbearable if the grace had been less. If it had been extended to just a few, even if the few had included me. The universal and unconditional nature of the love of God not only makes me trust him, it affects my relationship with all of humanity. First of all, by this ideal of love, I have continued to measure every scripture and every principle, every sermon, statement, or directive that is uttered or written by any church leader, and I respond accordingly. Nowadays, it leads me into trouble at times, either through inner conflict or because of outer suspicion. Also, I measure my own response to fellow human beings by this same criterion. Even in the awareness of my many and obvious failures, I am still inspired by love's possibilities as manifest in Christ because of its effect on me and upon the lives of people I have known. Secondly, because the gift of grace was purchased so dearly on behalf of all people, my view of others is necessarily more appreciative and compassionate. Their intrinsic worth has become fact for me instead of wishful thinking, and activity in the church has afforded plenty of opportunities for testing that belief so that I might know it subjectively, ultimately. For instance, when I was a primary president in Manchester, England, I was made aware of the power of belief. For weeks, half a dozen children, not members, ranging in age from 6 to 12, had been creating havoc in our meetings. The children were rude, wild, and unkempt. Four of them were the neglected children of a drunken father and an absentee mother. She wasn't at work, she just left periodically, and one could hardly blame her. Because of their destructive behavior, pressure was put upon me to deny those children access to the chapel. My life was a constant misery. The children were totally unresponsive. They even haunted our home. But also there were the understandable grumbles of some members. Even the bishop thought I was totally misguided, but nevertheless said, "It's up to you." There was the natural concern for the other children in primary and the effect upon them, but there was always the ache in my heart for these children, deprived as they were. That alone would not have made me as strong, but a deep belief in the innate value and goodness of those little hellions that sustained me and gave me the confidence to stand and would not allow me to cast them off was very vivid to me at the time. I knew that there would be no peace at all for me forever. I went contrary to that belief. But it was only when their self-destructive behavior brought a very negative response in the people around them, and which reduced me to tears, very painful tears on their behalf that they witnessed, did those children begin to realize that we really cared for them. And then the beginnings of change were seen. Many months later, 5 of them were baptized, but certainly their problems weren't over. From this wellspring of belief, a second imperative emerged in my response as a Mormon. Christ's gift of grace does imply faith in every one of God's children, and because there is value and great potential in each one of us, then it seems all means are required to realize it. Knowledge and wisdom were the things I hungered for most in my prayers as I was dealing with those children. I longed to find a way to love that might help them and get through to them. And there was a constant plea that they too might learn what they were doing to themselves. So my being Mormon became tied inevitably to the law of eternal progression as I understood it. I am aware that within the community of Latter-day Saints there are various aspects of this law which affect attitudes and responses in subtle ways. It all depends upon personal needs and hopes and perceived abilities. For some, eternal progression means simply an obstacle course, a testing procedure leading to the celestial kingdom. For others, it reflects the success ethic of mainstream America, a kind of spiritual or social Darwinism. For some, it represents a religious hierarchical progression of service leading to a general board or higher in the case of men, but ultimately leading to godhood. None of these has any appeal for me, the latter for quite selfish reasons. I cannot bear the thought of the pain that might be involved. Even Jesus wept. But from the beginning, in the light of divine love and the many challenges faced in answering that love, it has meant progression in terms of discovering my own spiritual truths and understanding. I have seen in others the positive effects of this. For example, one of the greatest privileges I had in the church in England was working with a young convert from Rochdale, a former mill girl. Without much formal education, she became, after joining the church, one of the most truly educated women I have known, because she was so hungry to learn and to understand. She was very strong, yet sensitive and compassionate as our State Relief Society president. I was her education counselor. She not only knew the scriptures, they were an integral part of her life, a source of her wisdom and strength, and she loved the saint and sinner in all of us. In the days when sisters were voted in at Relief Society, a ward president in our stake had refused to put one sister's name forward for the vote because the woman was living with a man, had done so for many years in common law marriage. She had about 5 children. Sister Hoyle believed with all her heart that this new convert should be admitted to the community of sisters unconditionally. But the president could not be persuaded, so Maureen Hoyle put her belief on the line. She asked me when I was visiting Salt Lake to get a ruling on the situation from the General Presidency of Relief Society. When I relayed to Sister Sharp the question that Maureen Hoyle had posed, Did they think she was erring on the side of mercy rather than obeying the demands of justice? Sister Sharp replied simply, "Didn't Jesus?" Maureen Hoyle, at the age of about 55, has just completed a mission to South Africa, and from her letters, she has faced many further challenges, and I would like to know how she resolved them. I know she would never skirt them. The law of eternal progression also provides for the development of character and integrity as spiritual truths are discovered, often painfully. Every talk I have given, every lesson I have prepared, has been a confrontation with my own inner convictions. Tensions have been discovered in my probing, and paradoxes have emerged that had sounded new depths in me as I've tried to resolve them. One such tension was my discovery of the priesthood restriction when a young black convert in England had to be told he could not be given the priesthood along with his white friend. He did not survive in the church, neither did his white friend. But another lady, black and married to a white man, faced the same trauma when her young son reached the age of 12. The whole branch to which she belonged rose in protest and almost apostatized en bloc. She did survive, and it was to some degree because of the support of those people, but also because through long nights of pain, she had arrived at her own dignity and knowledge born of a deeper relationship with God, one that feared not what man might do. I was there in her little branch visiting when, as Relief Society president, she told of her particular Gethsemane. What she needed now, she said, was their faith in her as well as their love. In her strength, she pulled that little branch together, and I often think now how she must be feeling now her faith has been justified. But I learn much from her about the ways we can help people and the wisdom that's required. My mentor, although he doesn't know it, Lowell Bennion, points out the need for loving intelligently with knowledge of human nature and its need. Quote, "Knowledge alone will not change society, but knowledgeable and compassionate men and women can improve almost any situation." End of quote. Arthur Bassett, in a recent lecture at BYU, which was reported in Sunstone Review, observed that love is not enough. Instead, he suggested, our question should be, how can I more adequately express love? Over the years, I have recognized that this question is not easily answered, whether it relates to our love of God or to suffering humanity. Loving can call, even on an individual basis, for an awareness of the unbelievable complexities of human nature. And many of my experiences in the church have brought a real hunger for that kind of wisdom and a recognition of my own ignorance. Being Mormon has always meant, I suppose, being hungry for truth, my own truth and understanding. Hubie Brown calls it the eternal quest, and I believe it is. The kind of quest, he says, which implies curiosity, a desire to know, a certain teachable humility, all of which are prerequisites to a successful search for truth. They who seek must have courage, must love truth, must be unafraid of new adventure. They must be willing to depart, if need be, from the beaten track and to alter and amend their opinions. They must have vision to see, valor to venture, and faith to sustain them on their quest. It was the newfound faith in the love of God that gave me the courage to depart from the beaten track, and I cannot halt that search. It was Hubie Brown also who said, eternal existence would be unbearable if that existence became fixed and static upon arrival in heaven, or I might add, upon arrival in the church. As Sunday school teacher in England, I found it difficult to contain the process, to quell the speculation, to temper the ongoing quest for meaning among a large group of 18-year-old converts, the liveliest class I have ever taught. But my first impression in Zion, until I became acquainted with Dialogue, Sunstone, Exponent 2, and the Mormon History Association members, had been that lifelong members, with the exception of some wonderful missionaries, were more likely to rest content, believing that answers were easily obtainable. I know differently now, of course. There are enough questions in this room, I am sure, to keep us going through the eternities. And that sounds so wonderful. In an address at BYU in 1958, President Brown quoted a prayer from the ancients which might well be echoed by the Mormons in this group. Quote, "From the cowardice that shrinks from new truth, from the laziness that is content with half-truth, from the arrogance that thinks it has all the truth, O God of truth, deliver us." In 1961, he urged the BYU faculty to teach so that, quote, "the minds and spirits of the men and women whose lives you touch may continue to be fresh, exciting, dynamic, and hungry." This, then, was the climate in which I spent my early years in the church. And it remains an essential part of what being Mormon means to me. It is the life and breath of my existence in the church, I'm afraid, and paradoxically, it is responsible for many of my discontents today. I am aware that there always has been a tendency for religious institutions to reify even relative truths, political, economic, or nationalistic. But in a universal church, I believe it is our obligation to resist this tendency, if the very nature of our faith is to survive in its pure intent. B.H. Roberts recognized that some would protest against investigation lest it threaten the integrity of accepted formulas of truth, which too often they confound with the truth itself, regarding the scaffolding and the building as one and the same thing. End of quote. But even this struggle against a conservative institutionalization of our faith is perhaps part of being Mormon. The need to exercise some control over what Joseph Smith described as a creedless church must be an ongoing temptation to those who lead us in this chaotic world. But my response can still be what I see as a peculiarly Mormon vital process. It represents the kind of personal challenge that gospel principles themselves would uphold. Tensions help me discover what my values are. Tensions, however, do need to be aired in order to see them and resolve them. Here at the symposium and in our unofficial forums and publications, my own view of what being Mormon means is encouraged to survive. Just as life is a process, so being Mormon for me is a process. It is not so much a state of being, a pattern of behavior, or a role, or an end in itself, as it is a means by which I might discover God, understand my fellow human beings, and get to know myself. Mormon beliefs and ideas stimulate my mind as well as my spirit. They create attitudes, and they motivate, even dictate, many of my responses. Those responses and actions in turn can help me find out, by testing my belief in loving service and communion, who I am and who my neighbors are. Belief and activity together should lead to my becoming a better person, a whole person in my own uniqueness, and help me to help others accomplish the same thing. I believe that the church as a vehicle can embrace differences quite happily and easily when sound principles are at the heart of it. Differences in perception of what being Mormon means can make the whole experience vital, exciting, and enriching. Our stimulating arguments with much-loved missionaries bore testimony of that. But variety can guard against stagnation and inflexibility too, even in our judgment of, quote, the good. When I joined the church, I could not have found words to define the constantly evolving effects of the new faith, nor could I have foreseen or understood the pain or the exhilaration of the challenging journey ahead. But these two central beliefs, of which I have given merely an outline, have been the threads that have bound me to the church. Despite the frustrations of what I have seen as excess baggage, and in spite of the discomforts and trials which have awaited me around many corners, my belief in the love of God and that of His Son for all humankind cannot fail to bring an answering response in me, giving me the security and the impetus to go on seeking, however painfully, my own deepest spiritual understanding. and it reminds me constantly too that others in their uniqueness must be afforded their own particular way. Today there are questions and problems that I never dreamed of 28 years ago. They are still unresolved, and I seek constantly to discuss them with fellow members, but time and attitude become less receptive to the kind of in-depth discussion required. Yet the ready-made community of faith, the opportunities for service, the sense of belonging, could be an aid to that end. It seems to be becoming less so. But this is the ideal which Being Mormon has generated me, and which is responsible for the choices and actions which at least reach out for that ideal. Until this paper, the ideal had been merely felt rather than consciously defined. Today, I still seek words to equal the awareness and the ache for truth, my own truth that is within me, that being Mormon means in my life. But for the time being, John Fiske's stirring words, as quoted by B.H. Roberts in 1912, may perhaps suffice. He said, "In this broad universe of God's wisdom and love, not leashes to restrain us are needed, but wings to sustain our flight. Let bold but reverent thought go on and probe creation's mysteries, till faith and knowledge make one music as before, but vaster."
Why don't we stand up for a minute? Just. No song. They'll all leave if we make too much noise. That's great. I realize the danger of allowing an opportunity to leave, but I thought it might be getting a little warm in here. You know, theological symposiums have a great deal in common with bullfights. The enjoyment of the association depends a great deal on the quality of the bull. I find it extremely difficult to follow this paper. Now I know why she wanted to go first. I suspect this is a typical Jesuit question, designed in hope that at least one answer will turn out to be correct. But I'm not sure that it's either. When I was young, I was the sort of little boy that my mother did not want me to play with. Some persons, certainly my mother, would suggest that I am in fact still growing up. So for my own protection, I suppose I would argue that being Mormon, at least being RLDS variety of Mormon, is more a matter of belief than of action. Even though I must confess here that my beliefs are not all that much better than my behavior. Yet my youth was controlled by the expectations of behavior rather than by belief. For we operate on the assumption that the children of church officials, nabobs my father called them, automatically believed. The real problem was to assure that their saintly behavior met the expectations of the critics. Much of my early Mormon action was restrained by the willingness of seeming strangers to stop me on the street and inquire, "What would Frank think?" As it turned out, I often heard what Frank thought about my behavior. But in all honesty, I do not remember any emphasis on what he believed. What was conveyed was a hazy set of assumptions that justified, if not rationalized, the behavior I was supposed to assume. So in answer to the question, my answer would be yes, and no, and neither. To be a Mormon in the genetic sense of the term is an attitude, I believe, an attitude of uniqueness, even peculiarity, which makes itself known in behavior, in beliefs, in relationships, in inquiries, but most of all, in religious experience. And what are they? First of all, I would suggest an attitude of elitists. I do not mean this in any widely derogatory sense, but rather to suggest that they see themselves as set apart by either divinity or history. They view the world, as well as other claims of divine manifestations, as platonic shadows, mere copies of the real or of the ideal. Such a view fabricates a high point from which to survey, gets them involved in a multiplicity of events and activities that most religious organizations would avoid, causes them to carry the burden of absolutes, and saturates their beliefs and their acts with the pressures of necessity. I acquaint this with the America's new fanaticism, jogging. I've always assumed that the joy of running was rather like that of wearing a fur coat in midsummer Georgia. The real joy comes in taking it off. The jogger tends to regard running as its own end, and elements of puritanical fanaticism easily insinuate themselves. Often Mormonism, I think, is an attitude which is its own end. Second, I feel the Mormon attitude assumes metaphysics as functional rather than essential. The role of theology and of philosophy and of history are more to dress up the process of being a Mormon than they are the sources or assumptions of Mormonism. Because of the immediacy of the venture, because of the explicitness of the message, because of the lack of any kind of identity distinction between spiritual and material, the concern for semantics is of little use and even less importance. Conversely, I detect a so-called embodiment rationale. The individualization of what seems to be uniquely social conditions and the socialization of what are uniquely individual conditions. In this attitude, events take on a concrete historical placement which are in the main unrelated to the conditions of their birth, perhaps best illustrated by the assumptions of the work of Jonathan Livingston Seagull, which, as Philip Slater has suggested, is a kind of Christian Science Dawn Patrol version of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. It confuses individualism with narcissism, community with containment, growth with compulsive striving, and spiritualism with schizoid alienation from the body. The assumption of Mormon community stands in stark contrast to their assumptions of agency, history in contrast to story, and belonging in contrast to owning. Fourth is the idea that authority stands apart from either dialectic or evolution. While not always seen in our execution, such an attitude draws respect for the finality and absolutes rather than for emergence. It is a difficult idea within the limitations of our theology, but note that Mormons express themselves by speaking with authority rather than in authority. The reality of our particular rationalization is to have authority. Example, the priesthood. But the attitude suggests that we really are in authority. DePillis suggests that Mormonism is best described as a quest for religious authority, and I would add only one thing. It is probably the quest for an explanation of an authority already assumed. For all intents and purposes, it is the process of allowing content to become assent. I tend to associate with this an attitude of a-intellectualism, not anti, as much as apathetic. This may be too harsh, probably will be misunderstood, but I refer to the frame of mind that acquaints publicity handouts with creative literature, and where the role of the intellect is foundationally suspect
and kept within the parameters of providing evidence for the already believed. Generally, we have assumed the attitude, if I might use the Talmudic expression, of putting a fence around the law, saying for purposes of this belief, everything outside of here is regarded as irrelevant, and everything in here is regarded as relevant. There is a Mormon attitude as well that sees itself as dynamic. I think this is probably true for the actions and beliefs of the RLDS and of the LDS in separate ways, but would suggest that there is a common conception, a product that may be larger than the total of its parts. It is the active pursuit of response to contemporary pressure, or in other words, to order and to organize the disorderly. After spending several hours recently in my liberal RLDS congregation, with its intergenerational worship, its feministic convictions, its enforced informality, its reentry of wind instruments into worship, and reeking of compromise with the undecided, I long for the peace and quiet of the old stone church where neither form nor content interfered with my apathy. But you see, I believe what the congregation is doing, and my behavior is reflective of this belief. I believe our Christian assumptions and our Mormon assumptions, but I am also aware that they are frosting on my firm, if somewhat bland, cake. I have only to give them order to make them mine. And while we may look with awe at the time it takes for us to adjust, I suspect we really have learned to do so fairly rapidly by comparison with other organizations. It explains, I believe, why in the Mormon movement, our dispersions, despite the liberals' complaint, are generally very passionate and very fundamentalistic. Last, let me suggest an attitude of revolution. I know that such a word strikes fear in some hearts and makes others laugh, for in practice we are rarely seen as revolutionaries. What I see is an attitude of revolution concerning the sacred cows of our environment, a legitimate heritage from the religious malcontent who was our founder. Note this is not rebellion. We are not trying to change leaders or alter the policies of the world, but to replace them with our own, to make it truly whatever it is we think it should be. It assumes that we can save the movement and or revitalize it by a reawakening from within, that by looking within the framework of our own movement, we can return to the glories of the past and to the promises of the future. We do not need to go outside for the keys to unlock the mysteries of our disintegration. They lie within the movement itself. Externally, our attitude has been one of quiet confrontation, being in but not of the world. I see this in the interesting response to the charge being leveled against Mormons of all variety that we are unchristian. It seems to me that one of LDS Mormonism's greatest selling tools has been the fact that they do not fit into the confines of traditional Christianity. I suspect, if anything, they are more Christian. On the other hand, RLDS has spent 100 years trying to convince the world we really are, and to fit into the mainstream of Protestant America. Now I discover that there are those within our official families who, on the RLDS side, are reaffirming their likeness with the Christian community as a whole, despite Jan Shipp's proclamation that Mormonism is the fourth and new religion in America. And on the RLDS side, a suggestion of discretionaries by which obviously operating under the reflection of Jesus the Christ is not really what Christian doctrine calls Christianity. In the latter case, at least, a new appreciation for our Jewish heritage as well. But despite these trends, I suspect I find an attitude of other than Christianness, and this attitude is one of revolution, not rebellion, against the tradition. I heard Eugene England's delightful presentation yesterday, What It Means to Be a Mormon Christian. It was not only an informative paper, but the best sermon, including exegesis, I have heard in years. I would suggest, however, it is not the Mormon's right to be called a Christian that is at stake. Certainly we have that right, for some of the best Christians I know are Mormons, or Jews, or even agnostics. In fact, my wife and I decided some years ago that if you're right, if eternal progression is really right and men become gods, we would like Leonard Arrington to be our God. See me then, it's more a matter of description, which asks, is Mormonism best described in the way the world describes belief and doctrines they call Christian? I think not. And I suspect that is an area which I'm sure we'll hear more from Eugene, if not others. But what in particular is an RLDS response to this question asked? For that, I'm going to have to say some things personal, and I know the danger in that. I'm not sure what I remember of childhood, other than some shared guilt arising from my mother's feministic view of the church, combined with a displaced urgency born of my father's industrious demands. There is no heavier burden, Linus told me far too late, than great potential. The unrest resulted in the feeling of exile or even of being outside. It was my response to the church that led me to build on a lot of reflections and beliefs and faith, as well as a great deal of borrowed courage, to make the shift from problem as life to problem as the mystery of life. A shift that allows me to see the possibilities, the dawning potentials of other directiveness, and the light as well as the lease on life. I was reluctant to burden this emergence into humanity with too many institutional attitudes. For to do so was not just to face the obvious exploitation of one person by others. It was more than that. A loss of spontaneity which makes of our attitudes little more than role-playing. For the sort of person one seems to be is more important than the sort of person one is. Arising from this bias and from my own experience, my inclination is to state that being RLDS is primarily an attitude, and to suggest that being LDS is about equal parts attitude and behavior. I would also add dash of poor memory. They are more pleased with persons who are not too loyal. The proper attitude suggests that to find one's religious expression only within the framework of the church is suspect. My feeling is this is not true for the LDS. Certainly the behavior syndrome for us is reflective of the Italian, if not the Spanish, Inquisition. And nothing makes a better story for the telling than the transgression of the saints. But really, such behavior reflections are not the heart or the mind of the movement, and in the main are reflections of the limited nature of our definable beliefs. For in those rare doctrinal confrontations, the encounters are passionate, and I think they are passionate, like academic battles, because the outcomes are so unimportant. Lacking doctrinal necessities, we are inclined to assume violations of things we don't believe in. The RLDS awareness of belief resides around a parameter of faith held in place by an attitude of expectation. Expectations of the nearness of clarity and of the rightness of the known, but as yet undefined statement. Maybe I can illustrate what I see as the distinction in this attitude between LDS and RLDS by saying that the LDS community, as I understand it, genuinely believes that if their church were to be given command of all things, the world would probably be in better shape than it is now. The RLDS church, on the other hand, would be very concerned if they thought their church would suddenly be in charge of anything. My RLDS heritage is not essentially the source of my hope or my convictions. Who and what I am is not being RLDS as much as it is the obvious reflection of that institution and its ideas upon my life. For the church was without question the midwife of my conceptions, yet I fight the isolation that exists between what is called for and what can be given. Camus reflects on the conflict that exists between a person's recognition of what is and what ought to be, and sees it as the ground for our sense of absurdity. I do not maintain an attitude of conviction about an awful lot of things. What I have is primarily an attitude that there are convictions, and that the message of the church is significant because it is where I receive my messages. For I need, or perhaps just want, something real. I borrow Nietzsche's words here. Alone, I confront a tremendous problem. It is a forest in which I lose myself, a virgin forest. I need help. I need disciples. I need a master. To obey would be sweet. If I had lost myself on a mountain, I would obey the men who knew the mountain, and if I should meet a man capable of enlightening me on moral issues, I would listen to him. I would follow him. But I find no one. No disciples, fewer masters. Eventually, I am alone. I disagree with Dr. Stout, who in this room about an hour ago stated religion emerges because of the need of those to face death. It is my belief that for most persons, the significance of religion is found in helping us to face life. And therein lies the recognition that within the church is a need either to end one's life and the uselessness of it, or to find in the nature of the struggle something which gives it meaning and purpose, and which in the final analysis makes living worthwhile. My Mormonism suggests that the ritualization of divine experience has become a means of removing from us the burden of our human relationships. There is an increasing effort, I think, to conform to tests of faith on the one hand and ritual performances on the other. Tests of faith range from abstinence of coffee by millions of sleepy-eyed LDS to the RLDS businessman scrupulously avoiding champagne at a company reception. We take great pride in our avoidance not only of evil, but in the larger and more successful requirement to avoid the appearance of evil. In rituals of performance, we pay our tithes, you far more than I. We kneel during the blessing of the bread and the wine, we seek temple recommends, or we follow the correct ordinances for the right offices, and on and on and on and on. In this performance, we are acutely aware that we are behaving as we ought. Yet it seems to me that our behavior often results from our human insistence on acting irrationally and illogically. This is not so much the failure to understand logic, for who really cares or does, but in the fact that neither empirical nor quantitative knowledge is complete, and that most of us have vastly undernourished views of men and women, of nature, and of God, and that this lack of nourishment is not due to limited information as much as to ignorance about how information comes. In my case here, suggesting that we are ignorant, notably, about sensuous knowledge. And for those confused at this point, I am not talking about the joys of sex, but the sensations of awareness. The depression of concerned and feeling people who are not sure that anything is happening is a result of behavior orientation, not belief. The depression this produces is like the guest speaker at the banquet, it needs no introduction. But what we are not aware of, I suspect, is that the rebellion against the dehumanizing process of authoritarian devices begins at this point. When the loneliness of powerlessness is encountered, then such loneliness becomes a human resource. It is a force that responds to indifference, to unresponsiveness, to manipulation, and meaningless communication. Persons need persons. But they rarely face this fact until they discover they are in a personless world. For persons need visions and dreams and hopes, not just eschatological promises. Yet these lie at the end of a journey that never really begins in earnest at any point short of their own self-isolation. Whitehead has pointed out to us that when a person is lost, what they really mean is that they know where they are, they just don't know where everybody else is. And such is the RLDS isolation. The yellow brick road may well begin, as it did with Dorothy, in the willingness to admit our human condition. I believe persons who have not learned to make the great human and religious achievements their own, who do not know what it means to earn a novel or carve a symphony or to express a divine experience, are either enslaved to capriciousness or to other persons' testimonies of life. As long as the mind keeps silent in the motionless word of reflection, everything becomes nostalgia. But with the initial moment of creation, the world cracks and tumbles and opens like a cosmic egg, and an infinite number of shimmering fragments emerge, all of which offer understanding. As our minds adjust to the horizons enlarged, it must renounce the comfort of familiar narrowness. It is dazzled when it emerges from its dark prison, awed to find itself suddenly in confrontation with time and space. In this sense, the church is not, should not, always be in the market for answers, but rather for liberating questions. Just that in their own way, these take us into the mysteries and respond for us to that void which resides among us. It is this urge to feel as well as to understand the awesomeness of the movement that gives us reasons to search, to seek, and to dream the impossible dreams. It is too bad we are often involved also in fighting the indefeatable foe. Not the least of my problems, I suppose, is that I have never found any RLDS or LDS who believe what the last one of that persuasion told me was essential. Behavior is easy to watch, to determine as correct, and to mimic if one is in need of the characteristics of belonging. But beliefs are different. They are difficult, and in the main they move like the traditional loop on a string, the loop ever there, but composed at different times with different combinations of ideas and concepts and assertions. Certainly being Mormon is what you believe, if one can set that belief in a set of parameters around which we circle like a firefly around a summer's night. But this is more an attitude in which a number of beliefs, one or two, or somehow more than half, balanced out as the metaphysical foundations to our contemporary theological assertions. Persons find that their assumptions of belief are such that they arrive at them either by their own inquiry or by adopting the beliefs of a community in which they find other significant reasons for joining. And in the main, they seem to find they are at home with a belief, even if they do not know what those beliefs are. The belief often is in being Mormon, not in what Mormons believe. So in response to the question, I would answer, it is an attitude. An attitude of being on the edge of fulfillment, an attitude of frustration, of exile and belonging, of concern and respect, the feeling of religious people about the source of their understanding. Yet there is a growing bifurcation in Mormonism, a split between the purification, if not the purity, of the doctrine on the one hand, and the awakening of the behaviorist, more in terms of Christian love than saintly behavior. Though there is a large segment of persons for whom the means have become and will remain the end. My comments on the LDS Church are obviously limited by knowledge and by experience. So relying on the LDS of the 1980s, I would suggest that this gap is widening as the pressures of fundamental reawakening cracks the complacency of those who have floated on the river of membership, never landing, never committed to the flow. The Mormon community has grown too accustomed to bridging this gap. Our attitude reflects it, but the promise of the future requires that we deal with it and once again make it whole. This is my hope, even my prayer. Thank you.
couple this morning. You did do a reading call.
On page 10, what about God delivers the cowardice of God?
Now you can sit down again. As I received various drafts of Irene's paper and kept waiting for Paul's, I began preparing my response. And as Paul's continued not to appear, I shifted my efforts to preparing a discussion of his little-known facts about his personality, antecedents, sock size, and ultimate destination. I decided on reflection that only the aspects of his dealing with his ultimate destination had theological implications, and those were of a highly speculative nature. But when we got together yesterday and compared notes, we found that Jack had neglected to tell him to send in a copy of his paper. In fact, Jack had neglected to tell him to write a paper. All Jack wanted him to say was, yes, he would come and do something. And when Paul said, well, I will feed my goldfish while I read selections from my undergraduate journal, Jack said, fine, we'll see you there. I believe there was some pressure from a program that was going to press. The question of belief and activity and their relationship to Mormonism is obviously as delightfully multifaceted as our presentations here today, and making a forced choice between belief and actions is, as both authors noted within the first paragraph, a red herring, but it does present some useful ways of approaching the tangled tensions and tendernesses that make up an individual's relationship to an institution that can be either a help or hindrance, and usually both simultaneously, during the complicated activities that we call life. I liked the redefinitions of both, opting neither for belief nor for actions, but for another expression. Irene's definition of it as a process, a means of knowing. Paul's as a set of attitudes. I was particularly intrigued by Irene's statement that Mormonism is a means by which I might discover God, understand my fellow human beings, and get to know myself. She mentioned the stimulation to mind and spirit, the creation and motivation of attitudes, and the testing out of those responses in actions with others toward the end of ultimate identity, not only hers and those of her fellow inhabitants of the planet, but that of God himself and herself. I added that. And Paul's expression of attitudes, I was particularly intrigued by the attitude of, by his singling out of attitudes of uniqueness with a kind of solipsism that is produced as an inevitable result, the utilitarian nature of Mormon metaphysics, and the detachment of authority from execution. I think that he unerringly put his finger on some of the sorer points on many of us who have prickly skins on such subjects. I think that these the attempt to come to private definitions are struggles that have produced such useful other ways of looking at that relationship as the image of the Liahona and the Iron Rodder, the image of the closet doubter, Bill Russell's view of communities within communities, and what I call the Miele syndrome, the to stay in the church, I must leave the church attitude that some people get from Sunday to Tuesday with, and sometimes decide that they must make it a permanent lifestyle. I do want, however, to concentrate my remarks for a few minutes before we turn it over to questions on an aspect that was touched on tangentially by both speakers, but not addressed directly by either. Belief is an interaction, and depending on the object of that interaction, we must, as believers, recognize and accept input from whatever that object might be. Let me just single out four types of interactions, although I'm sure that more could be identified. if the type of interaction is primarily devotional, the activities are such things as reading the scriptures, prayer and meditation, fasting, and so forth, with the object, a relationship with God and a worship of God. That means that the feedback from that object has an important impact on whether we feel that we are being successful in manifesting our belief through those actions. A second form of manifestation is liturgical and ritual. Participation in sacrament, baptism, temple work, even to some extent meetings that occur in a ritualistic way, such as Paul's nostalgia for the Old Stone Church meeting. Here, the process itself is the object, and the comfort of that process working as it should tells us how successful we are being. A third form is ecclesiastical and administrative, or programmatic, depending on what position you occupy in it. Here the focus is on activities. Their colleagues are either leaders or fellow teachers in an institution. You're either a supervisor or a supervisee. You're concentrating on achieving certain tasks or goals or minimum levels of statistics. This, I think, is without question the primary method of determining what being Mormon means for contemporary LDS Mormons. A fourth type of interaction is with the history and doctrine of the church and is primarily focused on intellectual content and the ability to gain knowledge and insight into the history and doctrine. It's a way of measuring our success as a believing, practicing Mormon. Now, of course, the same experience can be perceived through any one of those particular foci. The temple experience, for instance, can be an intensely personal meditative experience. At other times, the progression of the ritual itself can be its own reward, as you are comforted without you paying attention exactly to what's going on by the fact that it's happening as it always has. My parents are temple workers, and they are very concerned now with how many sessions per day, how many people per session, what the exact duties of each is in each session as it changes, and it's primarily an ecclesiastical approach. To someone, I presume, like Hugh Nibley, who can sit there and review the mystery religions of possibly 600 cultures during an endowment session, that may be primarily an intellectual activity of the endowment. But my point is, you are not alone, we are not alone as individuals in determining whether our engagement constitutes belief. We must accept, to some extent, input from this type of involvement about whether that's valid. Scripture reading, fasting, and praying are all part of the programmatic aspect of the church. These are ecclesiastically recommended and sanctioned, but there are some implied limits. 15 minutes is a kind of implied lower limit for scripture reading, but I think if people were to say, I have to go out on welfare, Bishop, because I just really feel that I must spend all of my time with the scriptures, that this would not be well received. Fasting is recommended for problems, but it's very widely counseled that these fasts be limited to 24 hours, and I think that if someone were to stagger in from a week on Mount Olympus saying, I have had this wonderful experience fasting, the bishop might want to talk about acceptable forms of fasting. Mortification of the flesh has never been recommended as a Mormon practice, even though it does have a long and respected place in Christian thought in general. In other words, the bishop has some input in deciding whether you are a believing Mormon or whether you're a raving lunatic. I think that all of us in this room are aware that people who are deeply involved in the historical and doctrinal aspects of the of our religious faith are sometimes regarded with suspicion by people who are involved in other types of interactions. I think that Michael Quinn's biography, excellent biography of J. Reuben Clark, was an enlightening confirmation to many of us that emphasis on activity is comparatively recent, and that a member of a first presidency who had spent several decades not going to church and not paying tithing was not thereby disqualified from ecclesiastical office. These kinds of things are interesting. It seems to me that even in the first, the devotional type of interaction, that we also accept input from God, and I find it interesting that we find God making statements to Joseph Smith that say, this is the only true and living church with which I am, collectively speaking, well pleased. Sounds very exclusionistic, and yet at the same time, throughout the history of the world, it seems quite obvious that a loving and creative personality has manifest love and acceptance in a variety of ways that I, for one, do not feel comfortable in denying, even though I know that it's popular to say, well, these are people who are being deceived. They couldn't have had a real revelation because they didn't have the priesthood. I have a feeling that whatever part of God's purpose is being manifest through institutional organizations, those organizations may make claims that are near absolute from a certain perspective, but I think that we may not understand God's perspective on any particular institution. I like the flexibility and options offered by this interchange between belief and action. I like the possibility of change. I like looking back on my life and realizing that I had a very firm testimony of seminary and teaching primary and going to Sunday school at a time when I thought Joseph Smith was a very strange person indeed, and that now that my testimony of going to primary is very shaky, that I feel much more comfortable with Joseph Smith. And that that I find my thoughts and interests centering increasingly on the Savior and the nature of His atonement. I am glad that there was a time when it was appropriate for me to be interested in primarily in ecclesiastical and administrative aspects, another time when a devotional emphasis seems to be meeting those needs. I think that during times when we feel estranged from God, that there are genuine rewards in immersing ourselves in service to others. And I think that the interplay of all of these actions is part of the kind of cosmic dance described by the ancients, that is a combination of strength and yielding, a listening to a compelling music and a choosing to be obedient to that, a combination of anticipation and fulfillment of movement and stillness and a complexity and a resolution into peace. And it is my hope that being Mormon can encompass all of these for all of us.